It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Milwaukee's schools are cutting some of their ties with the city's police department. We'll get the story from WPR's education reporter. First, to set the scene for today's edition of Food Friday and to set the table, a little Cajun music. That's the Beau Soleil Quartet performing at the Library of Congress. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we're going to talk about Cajun cooking. Melissa Martin is a native of South Louisiana and chef at the Mosquito Supper Club restaurant in New Orleans. Her new cookbook out is called Mosquito Supper Club, Cajun Recipes from a Disappearing Bayou. Melissa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, I love your cookbook. There's a lot of recipes, of course, but there's a lot of stories, too, including your own upbringing. Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood experience was eating on the bayou?
Well, I grew up in a tiny fishing village of about 3,000 people in Chauvin, Louisiana. We're located about an hour and a half southwest of New Orleans, right on the Gulf of Mexico. And all of my family were fishermen, so we pretty much just ate what we caught out the waters. So oysters, crabs, crawfish, lots and lots of shrimp were the ingredients that my mom cooked our daily meals with.
And in your book and at your restaurant, I understand you are trying, again, not just to serve up food, but to share the story of the people and the place. And it's bittersweet in some ways, as you say in the title, A Disappearing Bayou. Can you talk about your love of the region and your worries about it?
Yeah, I mean, we live right on the Gulf of Mexico, and so we have seen our state lose as much land as the state of Delaware. And so it's disheartening to think about what the future might be for this area in South Louisiana. And so we try to preserve the food by sharing it at our restaurant. We tell the stories of growing up on the bayou. And when we said disappearing, you know, recipes from a disappearing bayou, you know, it's not only land loss, but also, you know, losing a lot of traditions and cultures as, you know, generations of people pass away. There's such a shift and you lose so much. We've lost a lot of our French-speaking culture on the bayou as, you know, my grandparents who only spoke French passes away and, you know, things start to change. So there's a lot of shift happening in these areas in South Louisiana, and we try to bring you pieces of that in the restaurant in New Orleans.
And in your cookbook, and I think in your restaurant, you're not just doing Cajun dishes that, you know, might have reached us here in Wisconsin, the big flashy stuff we might see on TV. I get the impression that if I showed up at your house and you were making dinner, your cookbook, this is the kind of stuff you might serve to a guest.
Yeah, absolutely. We wanted to serve just the stuff that you could get if I took you down to my mother's house on Bayou Petit Caillou. And what she would serve us on a Wednesday or a Thursday or a Sunday, just the basic foods that I grew up. We definitely put some dishes on the table that just are inspired that my mother didn't serve, but we're not trying to, you know, reinvent the wheel and make these dishes fancy in any way. We're trying to serve them the way that these women made them and preserve them so that whenever you come to this restaurant, you really get that authentic experience.
Can you talk about some of the traditions that came together that have turned into the Cajun food we know today?
So I guess we can talk about gumbo. You know, I say in the cookbook that gumbo is sort of synonymous with Cajun food and Creole food, but you know, the gumbo that we know has come from so many different places in the world. Gumbo is the French word for okra. The gumbo that I cook definitely has roots in Senegal in Africa. Okra was brought to the United States by the slave trade, by slaves, and then planted. And then, you know, they sort of set the stage for how we would for growing okra and then how we would use okra. And so the gumbo, that's very important to me. You know, there's it has a direct link back to this place and this story, which is pretty important today being Juneteenth. And it's like that with most of the recipes in the book. Louisiana, there wasn't so many things that were native to Louisiana. Certainly the seafood was, but just like my grandmother's oyster soup, you know, she learned to use garlic when she came to New Orleans and met some Sicilian ladies. You know, so if you think about where the tomatoes are from or where the garlics are from, the roots are from, are spread all over the world. They just all kind of get shared down on the bayou and down in South Louisiana. And then this food becomes a hybrid of so many different nations, which is exciting. It's exciting to learn the roots of all these different ingredients and, you know, how it makes its way to South Louisiana and then how it becomes quote-unquote Cajun, you know, or Creole. And then also to acknowledge how it becomes when it's really something that's very, you know, simple and, you know, delicious. And that was sort of preserved by these women cooking it, women of all different nationalities.
We're talking to Melissa Martin, author of the new cookbook, Mosquito Supper Club, Cajun Recipes from a Disappearing Bayou. There's a lot of variety of flavors in your cookbook, Melissa, but what are some of the key flavors and spices that come up a lot in your cooking?
So definitely the Trinity, bell pepper, onions, and celery. We start almost every savory dish with. My spices are salt, pepper, cayenne, and hot sauce, and a bay leaf. Every once in a while, we sneak garlic in there. But if you have those basic things, you can make almost every, and the seafood, then you can make almost every savory dish in the book. You have to get tough with cutting onions because we use sort of an obscene amount of onions to make our dishes. And they're sort of the basis of so many things. So always 4 parts of onion to like 1 part bell pepper.
Now, you've shared a few recipes with us. We've got these up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's start with a bean recipe. You've got a lot of bean dishes in there, and you've got just a pretty straightforward one for white beans. Talk us through this.
Yeah, and so that's one of my very favorite beans is white beans. We use Camilla beans down on the bayou. You can also use Rancho Gordo. I specifically like the little cannelli beans. And that recipe can get started very quickly with some salt pork and beans and a little bit of onions in a big pot and some water, and you're sort of on your way. It's like a very uncomplicated recipe, and it's going to be super delicious in the end, and you can eat them all week. I like to have white beans with maybe some fried fish or some fried shrimp, but you can also have it with a pork chop if that's what you like. But it's a great dish in its own, or it's a great side dish to have all week long. We always have white beans with jambalaya, so I always say if I have to have a last meal, it's going to be jambalaya, white beans, and something fried. So.
And a big part of a lot of the cooking is rice, and I feel like I'm pretty good at boiling rice, white rice. But you've got a step in your white rice preparation that I'd never heard of before. I think it's the last thing you do in it. What's the key to making a good boiled rice?
So rice is, my mom always boiled rice. She learned that from my grandmother on the Martin side. And you boil your rice the same way you boil pasta. So you get a big pot of water with some salt in it up to a nice boil. Taste your water, make sure it tastes like the sea, and then you put your rice in and you boil it for 12 minutes, and then you strain it the same way you would strain pasta, give it a little quick cold water rinse, and then put it on a pan so that it cools off and doesn't get sticky. And it's kind of a foolproof method for cooking just like, you know, regular white rice. Not sushi rice or not brown rice. You would need a lot more time for brown rice, but just like, you know, the classic white rice that we ate. And one of the things about boiling rice is that it is really good as leftovers after, whereas if you steam rice, it might have a little bit more crunchiness to it and you have to get it back in the pot and kind of steam it again. But the white rice is really holds a lot of moisture and is really good as leftovers for the week.
We're talking about Cajun cooking with Melissa Martin, chef at the New Orleans restaurant Mosquito Supper Club, author of the new cookbook, Mosquito Supper Club, Cajun Recipes from a Disappearing Bayou. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Cajun-style recipe, dish, or restaurant you'd like to share? Or do you have a question for our guest about cooking and life on the bayou? Do you have a memory of maybe visiting the region? Or did you live there, maybe even grow up there? This is part of the food you grew up with. Love to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page and head over to WPR.org/Food Friday for a few recipes from Melissa. We'll pick up this Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're talking to Melissa Martin, author of the new cookbook, Mosquito Supper Club, Cajun Recipes from a Disappearing Bayou. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about Cajun cooking? Maybe about cooking and buying shrimp, crabs, oysters, crawfish? Looking for some advice on peeling or eating any of those? Do you have experiences with any of these kind of dishes you'd like to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. All right, Melissa, let's get to the seafood. And I hate to break it to you. Here in Wisconsin, we don't have access to stuff that's quite as fresh as you're going to have down there. Do you have any advice for us on how to make sure we're getting, say, if we're buying shrimp, that we're getting good stuff?
Well, if you're buying shrimp, I would just buy it from the same place I get it, which is Anna Marie Seafood, which you can go to annamarieseafood.com and get the same product that I use in my restaurant. I use shrimp from a couple of different shrimpers, but he ships worldwide. And whenever I do events outside of Louisiana, I always use him. Or you could use a place like Seat a Table, which is a very respected seafood purveyor. Look for people who are doing things sustainably, who aren't bringing together farm-raised stuff. You want to get sustainable domestic seafood. And I would just make some space in your freezer and then make a seafood order. Get yourself some shrimp and maybe some fish and a couple other things and have it in your freezer so that whenever you're ready to cook something, then you have something there. We always would buy about 500 pounds of shrimp and we would take all the heads off and then we would freeze them to have for a couple of months. So shrimp freeze really well. They don't lose their integrity and then you can have them there for, you know, any of your meals if you're experimenting.
Let's get to a meal. You shared a recipe with us for a fried soft shell, shrimp. Could you tell us how to fry up that shrimp?
So soft shell shrimp are really, really delicate. So I think I'd say in the book that you want to be really careful with them. And you can actually get those online through Anna Marie Seafood. And we always just make a really easy egg wash just with some egg, maybe a little bit of mustard, maybe some hot sauce, a little salt and pepper. Pass your soft shell shrimp in the egg and with one hand, we call it your wet hand, and then put it into your dredge mix. I think for the dredge mix, we're using cornmeal and cornstarch. And we do that because we have so many gluten-free people that come to the restaurant. But you could certainly use flour and cornstarch or flour and cornmeal. Season your dredge mix with a little bit of salt, pepper, and some cayenne. And, get your shrimp really covered in flour. And then just fry it up until it's golden. It doesn't take very long for a soft shell shrimp to fry. And then you can eat the whole thing so you don't waste the head. And they're such a delicacy.
Now, if we stock up on shrimp, maybe not the soft shell stuff, if we stock up on it, maybe not the 500 pounds that you get, give us a couple different ways that we're going to use this stuff out of the freezer.
Gumbo, jambalaya, shrimp stew, shrimp po' boys. Those are just a couple of things. Maybe you have a special occasion, you get some soft shell crabs and, you fry some soft shell crabs for some people. Maybe you get some crawfish tails in and you can do a crawfish etouffee or crawfish stew or crawfish rolls. crawfish hand pies, any of those things. I think that everyone should have a Louisiana theme party once a year, and then you can carouse a cookbook and get some ideas and, cook something authentic and traditional. And you don't have to follow the cookbook, all the way. It's really just a guide. So say you want to make white beans and you don't have the salt pork. Well, you can use bacon or, you can use a ham hock or you can use something else. And you can also make them vegetarian. The cookbook really is a guide to sort of help you feel the steps of how we would do it. And then you should definitely explore and experiment.
It's Food Friday. Melissa Martin is with us, author of the new cookbook, Mosquito Supper Club, Cajun Recipes from a Disappearing Bayou. Melissa, let's talk okra some now. You've mentioned it and using it in gumbo. Growing up, I couldn't have picked out okra in a lineup. Now I love it. We can grow it here in Wisconsin. I can't. I've already killed my okra plants somehow. But a lot of people, and you write about this in the book, a lot of people think okra, slimy, gross, don't want it. Talk to them, please.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, even my mom growing up was kind of horrified watching her dad eat okra out of a bowl. But now we, of course, embrace it. I mean, I love pickled okra. You can just slice okra and fry it straight in oil, and it's delicious. You can dredge it the same way you do the soft shell shrimp and fry it, and it's delicious. We take our okra and we smother it all day long until we have this okra paste, and we use that to make our gumbos. But it's really, really versatile. We just did a dish, oven roasted, shrimp and okra, which was also just pretty incredible. It's also really good raw. Using some acid to cut the slime of okra is really good when you're cooking it for a long time. That acid could be vinegar, it could be lemon, it could be tomatoes. But okra is just one of those really, really, special plants. It's also, you can eat the whole plant. So I didn't add any recipes for that, but it's kind of one of those nose to tail plants where everything,
like the leaves
is
and everything
about it. Yeah. And even a long time ago, people brewed coffee. They made a beverage that was like, when they couldn't get coffee, they used the okra seeds and they roasted them and they brewed that. There's actually a certain okra that's grown just for that purpose. There's also so many different varieties of okra. We could really just talk about okra.
And one more okra thing. Like, I've gone nuts for pickled okra lately, and I just buy it in jars at the store. But, is it easy to make a quick, simple, like, fridge pickle of okra?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I really encourage fridge pickles. I used to can a lot and, do the whole processing and boiling my cans and everything. And I think I just got really lazy, and now I make a lot of freezer jams and I make a lot of refrigerator pickles. And okra is definitely one of those where you can just, make yourself a little pickling liquid, put it in the fridge, and then just have a little bit in a couple of weeks. They'll have a really, really great flavor.
We've just got a few minutes left, and since we're toward the end here, let's talk about desserts. I saw some, some bread pudding and some others. What kind of desserts are your go-tos?
Well, right now it's blackberry season here in Louisiana, so tonight our restaurant is actually open. I'm at the restaurant right now, and so we'll be serving Papa Roo's ice cream and blackberry dumplings. I love making these blackberry dumplings. I'm essentially dropping a wet biscuit dough into a cauldron of stewed blackberries. It makes this really delicious dessert that we serve with the ice cream. I also really love that bread custard recipe that my mom made, really, really simple and easy to make and has a really unique taste that a lot of people will eat it and they'll say, oh yeah, my mom made something like this. And, they might be from Brazil or Argentina or different places. So it's kind of one of those, recipes that's, all around that people are making. Those are some of my favorite things to make.
And one theme in your book I didn't want to miss out on before we run out of time. You dedicate the book to your mom. You say that all the recipes in the book you learned from women. Can you talk about the role? You write, women are the backbone of the tiny village in which I was raised. They're the masters of sustaining and ensuring the survival of Bayou communities. Talk about that focus of your book, please.
Yeah, I mean, my mom was one of, I think, six women and in her family, and I lived next door to my grandmother. And, I mean, the truth is that the men fished, but the men didn't cook. And so women helped out on the boats, and then, you know, the catch was brought in, and then the women around me cooked all the food. And they didn't necessarily help me cook the food when I was growing up, but I watched them work. I watched a production kitchen. I watched them saw what they did with the seafood. I watched them stretch food. And it's what is still happening down the bayou. I mean, my mom and my aunts, I mean, my grandmother's passed. My mom and aunts are getting older, but they still are cooking the same way. They still are feeding each other. They're still being fed by the food that my dad is catching and my cousins are catching and bringing in. And they still are. One of the reasons that what's so exciting in Chauvin is that because they didn't get so really experimental, they, you know, kept these traditions alive, then the food has sort of remained the same. And so I've been able to document it.
We'll leave it there. Melissa, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you all so much. Have a good day.
You too. We've been talking to Melissa Martin. She's author of the cookbook and memoir named for her New Orleans restaurant, where we're letting her get back to work now. The book is called Mosquito Supper Club, Cajun Recipes from a Disappearing Bayou. You can find a few of the recipes that she shared with us today over at WPR.org/Food Friday. There's some fried soft shell shrimp. It's harder to say than it is to eat. White beans, a great white bean recipe there. And then a really basic one that I got to try her method just for your basic boiled white rice. She does a couple few things different than I do, and I really want to check it out. We're going to go out in just a moment with some Zydeco music from Jeffrey Broussard and the Creole Cowboys. Coming up after the news here on Central Time, we'll find out why the Milwaukee Public School District is ending a contract with the Milwaukee Police Department. This comes at a time when a lot of schools around Wisconsin and around the country are rethinking their relationship with police departments. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, catching and tagging fish to measure their numbers in different lakes is important, but it takes a lot of time and effort. We'll find out how environmental DNA could be a new tool for fish management here in Wisconsin. First, in a decision last night, Milwaukee's Public School Board of Directors decided unanimously to end a contract for Milwaukee Police Department officers patrolling campuses. Board members cited data that students of color have been treated unfairly by officers, they say disproportionately from other students. And while student and teacher groups have been pushing for a resolution like this for years in Milwaukee and some other districts in the state, the tipping point for Milwaukee came amid weeks of protests around violent treatment of black people by police around the country. WPR's K-12 education reporter Madeline Fox has been covering this story. She joins us now. Maddie, welcome back to Central Time. Do we have Maddie?
Oh, there you are. Yep, I can hear you now.
So, Maddie, can you give us the steps that led to this big move coming about yesterday?
Well, it kind of depends on how far back you want to start. There's been activist groups in the area pushing for this for at least a few years, and it's certainly been on the minds of a lot of education reformers and groups around the country for quite a while. But specifically, last week, two board members proposed a resolution that would terminate MPS's contract with the police department. And then the board called an emergency meeting for a special meeting, for last night, and they voted.
So that's after, you say, a few years of activism, a pretty quick turnaround. What kind of things did board members say about why they came to this decision?
I think what was so interesting is that what I heard from a lot of the board members is that they felt that this was overdue. So in particular, one of the board members, Megan O'Halloran, said, reminded other board members that they'd had a student, an MPS student, actually die at the hands of police earlier this year. That was Alvin Cole, who was shot at the Wauwatosa Mall. And she felt like this probably shouldn't have taken quite as much as it did for the board to really move forward on the issue. So that was really the driving sentiment, is that they felt that it was important to do because they felt like they should have done it already. But I think that the general momentum of the protests and so much of the thoughts about also, you know, racial disparities and how COVID-19 has been affecting communities in Milwaukee has really been pushing a lot of institutions around the city, as well as around the state, as well as around the country, to sort of examine the policies that they have and see what they can change.
Now, up till this decision, what has police presence looked like in Milwaukee schools? What kind of numbers of officers might students have seen on a given school day?
So it'll depend on where, on what school they're at. I talked to one student who said that they've got between 4 and 6 officers on campus on a given day. He's in high school, where there tends to be, I believe, a larger school resource officer presence. And so it does vary, but generally speaking, they have there's a lot of officers spread across the schools, depending on the areas. One of the teachers who's also been pushing for this change pointed out to me, they're also tend to be more heavily concentrated in schools that have a larger minority student body.
We're talking to Madeline Fox, WPR education reporter, looking at the Milwaukee Public Schools Board of Directors' decision, unanimous decision, to end a contract that stations Milwaukee Police Department officers in their schools. You talked to a high school sophomore, Chris English. I want to give a listen. Chris is a fellow, I understand, at the student-led group Leaders Igniting Transformation. Here's a listen.
All the hype that's built up to this is like, it's our time now. It's our time to get them up and out of here. The world is seeing why we don't need police in our school.
So what can you tell us about this group that's been advocating for us, Leaders Igniting Transformation, or LIT?
So they are among those groups that's been pushing for this for years. So LIT formed about 2.5 years ago, and this has been a core part of their platform since the beginning, was this idea of getting not just divesting from police contracts with the schools, but also then investing that money back into the schools with counselors, with restorative justice training for all the faculty, with different resources. So it's important to keep that in mind, that it's not just, they are not just pushing for end the police contract, but also do something with that money that will help sort of negate the causes that have been pointed to as reasons to even have police on campus in the first place.
Is that something that the board of directors talked about in this decision yesterday, investing in those things that the student group was talking about?
Yes, definitely. It's part of the resolution is to look at where to spend that money instead, with a particular emphasis on what various other groups that have been pushing for this have been asking for the money to be spent on. And actually, I talked to another teacher who said that, you know, the one thing that they don't want this to do is have the contract terminated and then sort of have it bogged down in committees for, you know, forever to try to figure out what to do with the money. There's been a lot of very concrete asks for what this money could go to instead. And so I think those weren't, you know, specifically detailed, you know, line by line in the resolution. But I think that there is a sense that they want to really start allocating that money as soon as possible to things like counselors, to things like restorative justice training, and so on.
Speaking of teachers, you talked to a teacher named Angela Harris, a first grade teacher at King Elementary and head of the Black Educators Caucus. Here's a listen.
To see where we've come in a year is really impressive. It's really inspiring, but it's also sad at the same time that it took the death of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and now Rayshard Brooks to kind of put us in this position where folks are like, oh, wait, maybe we really do need to look at this a little differently. So, it's bittersweet. It's bittersweet.
And was that a common sentiment among the people you talked to, Maddie? They were happy with the pace of change now that it started, but unhappy about what it took to get there?
Yeah, I think that that's sort of been, and I would say that that's not just been the case in terms of the Milwaukee Public School contract or school contracts with police in general. I think what I've heard as I've been out covering the protests for the last few weeks, is there's a lot of excitement at the momentum that's building, at the real policy changes that are being made. But there's also the sense of frustration that we don't really know anything differently now. I mean, we've been seeing really horrifying videos of men killed, men in particular, but actually all sorts of people killed by police for years. We've been having protests like this for years. And so it's really this sense of fatigue that they have to be out in the streets again, that they have to be pushing for this again. But also the sense of, well, at least some things seem to be changing.
Has the Milwaukee Police Department responded to the change?
Yes, actually, they sent an email just before the vote saying that they would support Milwaukee Public Schools board if they decided to terminate the contract, and that they were in agreement with the community voices that were saying, we want to see this money invested more in our students and in our community in ways that aren't policing. So that was actually, that took me a little bit by surprise, but that is where MPD landed on this.
And this isn't a complete dissociation, I understand. There's a different kind of program that Milwaukee Public Schools actually doesn't have the authority to remove. Do I have that right?
That's right. Actually, that was the source of quite a bit of the back and forth last night as the board members were talking about this resolution. There is a program that's established by state statute called truancy abatement and burglary suppression, which means which provides for four officers who focus specifically on truancy. And it also provides for a number of other programs as part of a partnership between MPS and the Boys and Girls Club and some other community stakeholders. But because it's in state statute, the board of directors can't just cleanly terminate the contract in the same way that they can with the Milwaukee Police Department for school resource officers. They did add onto the resolution a caveat that they want to sort of see if they can hold on to the money that would have gone into the TABS program and talk to the city attorney and see if there's a way to invest this money in things, again, other than police officers. But they don't necessarily have the same kind of unilateral authority to do that as they did with SROs.
You've been following this story closely in Milwaukee, and as you mentioned, the protests. Is this something that you're seeing other districts in Wisconsin start to think about?
Think about, yes. In Madison in particular, you know, the teachers union has come out in support of terminating their contract with the police, and the school board president has also supported it, but they don't really have a timeline for doing anything about that. And actually, it's worth putting into context that as far as I can tell, and it's hard to know because there are, you know, thousands of school districts across the country, but Milwaukee is kind of early in this. I mean, we saw it in Minneapolis, we saw it in Denver, we saw it in Portland, Oregon, and then as far as I can tell, Milwaukee seems to be the fourth major school district to do something like this. So there is, you know, a tentative look at it in other districts in Wisconsin, but it's not a new idea, but it is taking some getting used to, I think, among leaders around the state.
Maddie, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Madeline Fox, Milwaukee-based K-12 education reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. We talked with her today about Milwaukee's unanimous school board vote and its contract with the city's police department. Coming up, we'll find out how DNA in water samples is showing potential as a tool to measure fish populations, including walleye, in Wisconsin lakes. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin man shares the timeline of his direct personal experiences with racism starting at age 10. Now, one fish, two fish, it sounds like it's real easy to count fish, if you believe Dr. Seuss, but it's harder than it sounds to keep tabs on fish populations in Wisconsin lakes. Wildlife managers need good counts to know how to set things like bag limits or if they need to restock lakes, especially when it comes to the popular fish like walleye. Getting that data normally takes a lot of time and effort, but researchers at UW-Madison are looking into a new way to count fish by analyzing the environmental DNA contained in water samples. Our next guest looked at the eDNA profiles of 24 Wisconsin lakes and sees the strategy as potentially a helpful tool in fish management here in the state. Mike Spear is a PhD student in the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. The results of his study were recently published in the journal Environmental DNA. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, as things stand, the state of the art, I understand, is the traditional bag and tag method of estimating the number of fish. How does that work?
Yeah, that's right. Traditionally, we try to estimate populations of fish, including popular sport fish like walleye, in our lakes using bag and tag, or what we call mark recapture methods. And that involves a crew of biologists and technicians to go out and set nets in these lakes, try and capture as many fish as they can, and then they mark those fish with either a special tag or take a clipping of their fin. And then they go back to that lake a few days later, and usually with big electroshocking boats, and they electrify the water. And again, they capture as many fish as they can. And based on the number of fish that they catch the second time around that are marked from the first time or unmarked, they're able to estimate the total population of fish in the lake.
Okay, so if I'm catching different fish the second time around, that indicates that there's more of them out there. So this sounds labor-intensive. Does this limit the number of lakes that actually get surveyed for fish like walleye?
It does. It's pretty time and labor-intensive. In the northern part of the state, the real walleye lake-rich region, we've got about 900 walleye lakes in Wisconsin. But the state and tribal fishery managers who do this bag-and-tag method are really only sampling 25 to at most 50 lakes a year, able to estimate their populations. And these estimates are what underpin the management of the walleye in the state, particularly setting bag limits, knowing when we can keep harvesting fish from these lakes and when we should stop. So trying to manage a 900 systems based on, you know, roughly only 5% of those lakes is a tall task.
So a lot of these lakes, we're kind of making our best guess maybe based on what we've seen in a nearby lake. Is that often what we end up doing?
Yeah, so there are a handful, or there are a lot of lakes really that we get trend data on over time, but usually we're only sampling those lakes every 5 or 10 years. And so these management regimes aren't that sensitive to changing populations, and often we're relying on nearby lakes to set management efforts for other lakes.
All right, let's get into this environmental DNA, or eDNA for short. What is this?
Environmental DNA is a molecule in the environment. So like you might see at a crime scene, a detective might be able to swab a counter or a doorknob and get a sense for who was there at the time of the crime. Similarly, we can go out into the environment and take a sample from the water or the dirt in that environment, and it contains traces of plants and animals that are there or have been there.
And those are, I guess, like a fingerprint, a DNA fingerprint for how many different fish might be in a place?
Exactly. So you could use it to estimate, you know, the biodiversity of a lake, per se, the different kinds of fish that are living there. Or if you zero in on one species and you count the number of DNA molecules that are there, you can get an idea of how big the population of that species might be.
We're talking to Mike Spear, a PhD student in the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison. He's talking about work he's doing using environmental DNA to track populations of fish in Wisconsin, things like walleye in this study. So, Mike, your step now, as I understand this recent research, is to try to calibrate, to try to figure out if this DNA testing gives us similar results to the old-fashioned method. How do you do that?
Right. So we've got great work done by the state and tribal managers from the Wisconsin DNR and Glyphwick, and they go out and they do these mark recapture methods. And so what we were trying to do is follow up on those traditional surveys with this emerging molecular technique. And so we'll go around a lake and we'll collect water samples, bring them back to the lab, filter them onto filter paper, and then extract the DNA from those samples, counting how many DNA belong to the walleye and estimating that as a number of fish in the lake.
All right, let's talk about gear. First of all, the basic stuff, what do you collect? What are you going around collecting samples with? Just a bucket?
Yeah, so we've got just pretty basic water bottles, Nalgene water bottles, like you might throw in your hiking bag. So it's pretty low-tech and really not personnel or time-intensive at all. I can load up a truck with a boat and a couple of Nalgene bottles and be back off a lake in 20 minutes, whereas the traditional technique, you'd need many technicians and big electroshocking boats and fishing nets. So it sort of simplifies things on the front end,
Right.
On the back end, I have to take those samples into the lab and do some molecular work in a clean lab so we don't contaminate the samples with other fish DNA. So it's a little more complicated on the back end. But the advantage of that is we can limit the time we spend in the field and spread the time out in the lab over longer periods of time because the DNA is pretty stable in the fridge or the freezer.
That's how stable is it in the water? Is it, if I'm taking a sample today, is that giving us DNA that's pretty recent, or could there be DNA still floating, I don't know, from last year or years before? I don't know how long DNA keeps.
Sure. And then that's a great question and one that we're really interested as biologists, because not only can we manage fisheries with this technique, but we can look for eDNA of species of concern, maybe invasive species mm-hmm. that we don't want in our lakes, but we're looking for, or species that are close to extinction and we want to see if they're still there. And the consensus is usually on the order of days to weeks. And so if you're sampling the water, we're pretty sure that that fish or animal or plant was pretty recently nearby.
Okay, so you're collecting these samples, testing them in the lab, and you're trying to calibrate if it gives us a similar indication as the old-fashioned bag and tag method. How does it match up so far?
Well, we collected data on 24 lakes over the last couple of years, and the results are really promising. We're seeing a really strong correlation between the traditional bag and tag method and our new molecular environmental DNA method, so much so that we're able to predict with pretty good confidence how many fish might be in a lake to the effect that, you know, we would know when to close a lake down to fishing or limit the bag size on a particular lake, or know when we can go with a business as usual approach. Now, it's important to mention that this method is not meant to replace the traditional sampling. There's, from a biologist's perspective, there's no better thing than to have a fish in hand. And so there's a lot of uncertainty when you're sort of obliquely sampling a population with sort of secondary evidence, this DNA that's left behind. You'll never know necessarily the size of any individual fish or the ratio of the sexes or important demographic information. But as a complementary method, you know, we might be able to expand on that 50 lakes a year that we're able to get, that sort of 5% of our walleye populations, and maybe get a little bit more information on a lot more lakes.
What would it take to get from here to there to know that we're confident enough in this that we could expand this DNA testing, as you say, alongside the bag and tag that we're already doing?
Sure. So the work that we've done over the last couple of years has established that there is a relationship, and a very strong relationship, between the number of walleye in a lake and the amount of eDNA that we're able to recover. So statistically speaking, when you have a relationship, you can only get better at predicting when you have more sample size, when you go out to more lakes and you use both methods so that you can really fine tune this. So definitely 24 lakes is a great start, but I think we're continuing to work closely with state and tribal fisheries managers to see what we can do to push that sample size up. And the more we do that, the better we'll be able to predict how many walleye are in a lake with just a few cups of water.
You've been doing walleye so far, and that's very popular with people who fish and people who eat fish, but there are a lot of other fish in the lake. Are you looking to expand this to other types of sport fish in Wisconsin?
That's a good question. We're working on a project with the United States Geological Survey and some folks in La Crosse, Wisconsin, on developing a tool that would be able to sample sort of all fish. So in this particular study that we talked about quantifying fish, we looked for a specific stretch of DNA that only belongs to walleye. But in this new study, we're looking at larger stretches of DNA where we would capture all fish and then sequence each of those DNA strands so we know a full census of the fish that are in the lake.
Wow. So we could end up maybe with a test just in our last few moments that gives us a pretty full census of all the kinds of fish in a lake?
Well, that's the goal. You know, the technology is on its way there. I don't know that we're there quite yet. There's a lot of uncertainty that happens between a fish being in the lake and their DNA being in our sample. Every fish is different. Every species of fish is different. They're all shedding DNA at different rates, and they live in different spots in the lake. So there's a lot still to be worked out, but that's sort of holy grail of eDNA is to take a sample of water and know exactly which fish are in your lake.
We'll watch for that. Thanks to our guest, Mike Spear, PhD student in the Center for Limnology at UW-Madison, talking about the use of environmental DNA to help count fish in lakes. If you've ever been jealous of birds because they can fly and you can't, here's something else they can do. They can see a lot more colors than we can, many of them, anyway. According to research published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, some bird species can see a range of colors that's wider than our range of colors. We humans, from red to violet on the spectrum. But a lot of birds and reptiles and fish have an extra cone in their eyes that lets them detect ultraviolet light. And on top of that, then they can see color combos that we can't, like when you mix ultraviolet with like red or something. Researchers tested this out on hummingbirds. These guys like sugar water, so scientists put out feeders that had sugar water and some that had just plain old boring water. They color-coded the feeders using colors that had ultraviolet hues that you and I can't see, but the hummingbirds can. No matter how you sliced it, the hummingbirds could figure out which color matched up with sugar water, and they kept coming back to that color even when scientists moved the feeders around the room. Change the color-coding system, and the hummingbirds keep coming back to the color that used to have sugar water. Till they figure it out, things have changed, they move on to the new colors. What does the color ultraviolet look like to those hummingbirds? I don't know. I'm only human. I don't have the sensory makeup to describe it. But scientists say we could think of humans as watching black and white TV and hummingbirds having color TV. It's bird news you can use. This is Central Time.